I really didn't feel like working tonight, so I invited some friends to come over and take over the broadcast. We've got Haughty by Nature. That is the name of the crew, the name of their podcast. Carl Eggers.
Hello.
Gary Miller.
Hey, Walter.
And Brandon Peterson.
Good evening.
Who, you know, of course, with that last one, you got to tack on former state senator. It's very important.
It really is.
To
hear that.
You
hear that. You better.
Every single day I have to hear that.
One more day. Every day plus one.
The Honorable.
The honorable
Senator, actually.
The Honorable.
I think
now,
it's how the letters
came in. We might be pushing a little bit. Closing arguments, the name of this program. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. Two ways to stream this program. We are live and local 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you tuning in. You can catch the podcast if you happen to miss the program live by just doing a search for Closing Argument right there in your iHeartRadio app. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us if you want to be a fifth or sixth, depending on how often Brad chimes in voice on the program this evening. We will welcome your voice to the cacophony of crazy that's about to take place here. I really do appreciate having you guys in, and you know, it's only half a joke when I say that it means less work for me. I like what you guys are doing with your podcast, Haughty by Nature, which I could sincerely recommend before I listen to a single minute of, just by virtue of the fact that you guys are doing it. And I happen to know, you know, each of you individually to be, you know, thoughtful, articulate, and occasionally funny people who managed to bring some insight to the news of the day that's different than what you're likely to hear from most sources. And now that I have actually listened to it, I just double down on that. It's worth your time. Haughty by Nature, you can search your iTunes account, the iTunes store, or just your regular old podcast, pod catcher, whatever it is they call them. I was able to find it in my generic pod catcher. So it's worth your time. And, you know, what we're going to do tonight, we have the usual cacophony of headlines that we can go through. We want to talk about, of course, the election, which took place last night, both nationally and locally, kind of break that down a little bit, and ask some questions that I don't think you're allowed to ask in polite mainstream discussions, such as, should we even have elections? Is it even worthwhile to vote? Right? Is the state a thing that should exist? I mean, these are things that you guys tend to mull over on your podcast. And I'm more than happy to turn over this air to, you know, basically have it be a Haughty sampler, as it will, for as long as you guys want to be here tonight. So, you know, that's me introing you. Tell us a little bit about the podcast and how it is that the three of you even came together in the first place, and then we'll get into some of these headlines.
Yeah, I think you nailed it really well, and we appreciate the compliments, Walter, and I'm Carl, and Gary and Brandon, we're friends, and we thought it'd be fun. We've had a great time just talking at the bar together. We thought maybe we should record this, and then we have a podcast is how it worked. And I think his Walter's comments about should we even have a state at all was directed at you, Gary.
Yes, that's right.
Generally the
we're prepared to have that conversation this evening.
Well, and that's just it, is that there is a spectrum. You know, when people throw out the word libertarian, there's a certain caricature that probably comes to mind depending upon, you know, whatever the individual's perspective is of libertarianism. But it's a big tent in the real sense, in terms of not only what ideas are included within that scope, but how people choose to apply them. And your guys' discussions on your podcast kind of bears that out.
That's a nice way to set it up for Gary. Is that's sort of the Catholicism, your thoughts. All right, Gary, the relationship between the state and man, go. But you've got about 90 seconds, 120 seconds.
Right. You know, they just doubled the Twitter character count, so, you know, now we can have really, truly pithy conversations online. Yeah. I'm sure it's going to increase the quality of... Yes, finally, we've reached the point where we can really get into the deep stuff.
That's actually a game changer for me, I got to tell you. That would make me more of a Twitter guy.
I think it's going to make me more of a Twitter guy. Yeah. I mean, I tweeted out earlier tonight, which I don't usually tweet. You know, 140 just wasn't enough. It really, truly wasn't. Now, 280 isn't, you know, amazing by any stretch of the imagination. Yeah, literally double. That's true. You could, if you're trying to sell it, literally double is the way to do so.
140 was the beauty of it, though.
Yeah, you think so, Brad?
Because there's an art to the brevity of it.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm not brief, though. Like, if I can't put a prepositional phrase in somewhere in my social media post, then
it
doesn't work for me.
One thing you have to know about our podcast is Gary will quickly take things to the metaphysical and the absurd in both beautiful and horrifying ways. So you need more than 140 or 180
you
characters
can't
to
do
get
that
there.
On Twitter.
You can't do that on Twitter. Yeah.
There really aren't enough characters, actually.
There's one character. Right. Character.
Yeah. Once you spell out metaphysical, that's like a quarter of your characters gone, right? And on Twitter. That's the thing is, yeah, I get the art of the brevity. That's true. There is a value there, but you have to weigh that against the limitation of actually being able to convey a concept. I had an editor once. And one of the things he said that I will remember until the day I die is he's like, there's a reason why people write and read books. And it's because it takes a book to convey an idea. Like, in order to actually understand something at its root and how it applies in the real world, it requires a certain amount of time and a certain amount of investment in thinking about and considering and digesting. And Twitter is literally the opposite of that.
Right.
You know,
I was going to say Twitter is literally none of those things.
Yes.
Like, I'm like, wait, people are thinking about things and breaking. I think Twitter is just I'm a 140 character guy. I'm I think the Twitter intelligentsia, the old guard is 140 characters. I'm actually out of principle may stay at 140 characters. Yeah.
Nice.
Brevity is the soul of wit, as former state senator Dave Thompson used to.
I think that was Shakespeare.
But it was whatever Dave Thompson. I'm giving credit. It's like the Michael Scott, the quote of the quote.
Yeah, right. You know? Wayne Gretzky.
Wayne Gretzky. Yeah, exactly. So
that's very volunteeristic of you. Yeah, if that's the proper way to say that word.
Yeah,
you're gonna impose your own limitation on your Twitter usage. All right, let's take a look at what happened last night / today, because in the world of ranked choice voting, apparently elections take half a week now. According to the Star Tribune, Jacob Frey soundly defeated Mayor Betsy Hodges and 14 other candidates Tuesday after presenting himself as a mayor who will be visible, willing to compromise, and relentlessly enthusiastic about the city. A 36-year-old native of Virginia who was drawn to Minneapolis after running a marathon here, Frey is a lawyer and first-term city council member representing parts of downtown and northeast Minneapolis. Do we have that clip of what he had to say regarding his win?
Yes, we do.
Let's play that.
People said we were too young, too ambitious, and not from here. They also said that, they also attacked us because we weren't willing to take an ideological purist position on every single issue. But, you know, it's our position that that's not the right way to run a city. And so moving forward, item number one on the docket is to start uniting. Item number one on the docket is to start working with the new city council, our city staff, the independent school and park board, to create a set of values that we as a city of Minneapolis can rally around. And once we've established that there are core values and beliefs that we collectively hold in our city, then I'm hopeful that regardless of disagreements that will inevitably come, we can start treating each other a little bit better. We don't need to be this city where we're viciously attacking one another all the time. You know, we're a city that has a whole lot of good people in, and I'm proud to be one of them.
So from a conventional political analysis, this sounds really good. Like, he's obviously a talented speaker. From my libertarian ideological perspective, I've taken apart this word salad and a number of questions come to mind. Like, first of all, does he have some sense? And we were going to have the opportunity to ask him this tonight, but unfortunately, through whatever circumstances, he agreed to be on the show and then had to cancel. But what are those core values he's speaking of that are representative of Minneapolis? What does unity look like in Minneapolis? What is a common value? And, you know, what do you say to the person who stands outside of all of that? right? I mean, what exactly is it that is he actually saying anything at all there, or is it just
no?
Yeah,
not at all.
That's my answer.
Brevity.
You know what? I disagree fundamentally, and let me tell you why. I'm a, as you may have picked up, Walter, I'm a resident of North Minneapolis, but I entertain in Northeast and Robbinsdale and downtown. So I am acutely aware of the cultural differences in different parts of town. And everything that the mayor-elect said signaled, I am the mayor of the beautiful people. Like, I am the mayor. I'm the mayor of downtown Minneapolis, and that's where our priorities lie. Because I didn't hear anything in there that wasn't focused on commerce and making everything beautiful. And you know what I'm saying?
So when he talks about unity, you don't think he's necessarily referring to any of the racial equity stuff that's been so prominent within the campaign and in the news and what have you, and that a lot of the activists that were either running or supporting candidates in the race were hot and bothered about?
I think all I heard in that speech, which was actually very brilliant, by the way, he's clearly a talented communicator. Right. We will hear from him 25 years from now. He'll still be part of our conversation.
Oh, God.
I mean, he'll be around. He's a guy who could, you know, climb some ladders, because I think he's that.
No, I agree. I agree. Yeah. He's got, if he chooses to be, and sans any, you know, ridiculous gaffe that, although nowadays apparently there are no gaffes anymore. You know, people can do literally anything, say well, literally anything.
He said we're not ideological purists.
Yeah, that's yeah, not yeah. How that's we really govern. Interesting. Yeah.
Okay, so that means you constantly compromise and have no
right.
Moral framework whatsoever.
Right.
That's what I heard. That's the initial thought. But then, two, that can't possibly be true, because there are values we as a society hold that I assume he holds, like inclusiveness and compassion and things. So then how can they both be true? It's total garbage. Political speech is what it is. It sounds good, but it means nothing.
How do you even arrive at the premise that we ought to be united, or that we ought to seek some sort of common values, if you haven't gone through some sort of ideological process to determine that that's a worthy goal? You know, it's kind of like the whole notion of moral relativism. That there is no right, there is no wrong.
That
well, you
itself.
Just made a moral statement, right? So it's this kind of, but you know. I have these questions, I have these reactions to comments like this, and then I have the sad realization that I'm one of possibly five or six people who's actually thinking on that level about the implications of political speak.
And then you realize, maybe the three of us have come to the realization, probably more so than you have, Walter, you're still in a different camp as far as the efficacy of voting itself, right? I mean, we're at different... You know, there's different spectrum over here, but, you know, that's what we're talking about, the kind of differences.
Let's talk about that when we come back. The efficacy of voting itself, is it even worth it to go to the polls? Do you have a duty, a civic duty, to cast your vote? Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, in studio, the Haughty by Nature crew. You can check out their podcast on iTunes or wherever podcasts are freely downloaded. 651-989-5855, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Too many broken hearts are falling in the river. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. In studio tonight with the Haughty by Nature crew. That's the name of their podcast. You can find it on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Carl Eggers, Gary Miller, Brandon Peterson. Appreciate having you guys in the studio tonight. 651-989-5855 if you want to join us this evening. We left off, you know, we were reflecting upon the outcome in the mayoral race in Minneapolis. Jacob Frey is going to be the new mayor of Minneapolis starting next year. And he had some pretty words for the folks. And we were kind of breaking that down, trying to analyze whether or not there's any actual substance behind the admittedly effective rhetoric. And that has led us to the question, the conversation about, you know, voting generally, this ceremony that we take place, that we participate in, this ritual of participatory government. Is there actually a there? We're daring to ask the question, is there really any value in participating in the process at this point? And I'm going to directly ask that question to my three in-studio guests and get the spectrum of answers from Haughty by Nature. Have at it.
My take is we have nobody else to blame but ourselves for where we are as a country, for who's in office, who's leading us, be it Trump or Hillary or whomever. We have nobody to blame but ourselves. And that's a really positive, happy message that I want to communicate to the entire world, that you should be ashamed of yourselves. But it's just hysterical that people think voting the right, the next way will solve the problems that we're facing as a society. And I think it's definitionally ludicrous.
It seems as though maybe I misunderstood what you were saying there, because I perceive seemingly contradictory ideas. On the one hand, because what I perceived was we get the government we deserve. Is that kind of what you were saying?
We get the government we elect.
We get the government we elect, yet at the same time, participating in the electoral process, you're suggesting, isn't a worthwhile activity. So is there a contradiction there?
You can rest your hat on the idea that ultimately, eventually, someday, it will be worthwhile. Mm-hmm. But over 250 years of history of going deeper and deeper into the swamp, I don't think we've proven that we can handle the responsibility of electing leaders for this country, and we have to reevaluate ourselves more than anything. I think more than the people that we elect, we have to reevaluate what do we hold dear as a citizenry and as an electorate. And that's where I place blame, and like also pointing the finger back at myself too. Gary, what do you?
Walter, I thought one observation is when you were teeing up what voting is, you called it by two words, ritual. And what was the other one?
Ceremony, I think.
Ceremony, yeah. Both of which have very distinct religious overtones to them. And so I'm the haughty guy who thinks that the very premise is anathema to humanity, such that I don't believe that the state should have, that kind of... should not be empowered by a tiny minority of a minority that can pillage the other 95% at will.
It's interesting you should phrase it that way, because, as I was contemplating, knowing that we were going to talk about this at some point tonight, I was thinking about it earlier today, and I was specifically thinking about the concept of this so-called mandate that people always talk about in the wake of an election. So-and-so has a mandate now because they were elected by, quote, the people, right? Now, just on its face, just mathematically, there's a problem with that, right? Because depending upon the election, the presidential elections tend to have relatively decent turnout, if by decent you mean somewhere in the 60 to 70% range of people showing up. But like in Minneapolis, they were popping corks because they got, 40 and above, like just above 40% participation. So way less than half of the people showed up to vote, and a fraction of those people voted for the guy who is now going to be mayor. And yet there's this concept of he now has the mandate to do all the things he said he was going to do. There's an inherent problem with that, right? Like if the idea is that you're going to be represented by this person that you have just elected, then but the actual affirmation of your representation was a fraction of the population. Mm-hmm. There's a disconnect there, it occurs to me.
And particularly when there's levies involved. I mean, we're talking about, folks who are living on a pension or just living off their Social Security, living somewhere, and all of a sudden the population of the local, municipality changes, and all of a sudden their monthly, payment goes up by a market amount where they have to start making decisions on what they're... It's literally imposing a violent will on other members of society, and I basically decided it's an act of violence that I can't be party to, because any candidate on the ballot appropriates the state for some absolutely nefarious purposes. It just alternates.
Well, I think it really gets down to our base primal values as humanity of to be led or to blame the strong man. And to have a leader, and either to cherish and to venerate that leader, or to blame them for all of society's problems. I'm blaming us as a people for doing that, for looking to somebody else to solve my problems, for looking to somebody else, even via the political system, to fix what I think is wrong. And I think that's an incredibly dumb way to try to solve society's problems. How about you talk to your neighbor? How about you, treat each other better? How about you work hard and try to better yourself, and or just be kind and generous to your neighbor? That's more effective than placing a vote, especially in an election that has 30% or less turnout, or even 40% or less.
It kind of comes back around to the concept that Jacob Frey mentioned in his remarks that we heard in the last segment of trying to unite, trying to find unity. And, you know, regardless of party affiliation, ideological affiliation, this is a piece of rhetoric that you hear on a relatively routine basis. We need unity. We need to come together. We need to heal the divide. And it occurs to me that virtually no one, probably, it might be fair to say no one who employs that rhetoric has any real sense of what the prerequisite to the type of unity they're talking about is, right? Because the whole premise of the system is you cobble together a political coalition that is opposed inherently to another political coalition or multiple other political coalitions. You obtain political victory. We use this kind of militaristic terminology regarding elections, right? You obtain victory, you conquer, and then you get to impose your will through your newfound mandate upon those whom you conquered. There's nothing unifying about that, right? Like, that's, you now get to determine what everybody's life is going to be like.
Exactly. And as government continues at every level to grow at, you know, geometric rates now, we're in the end game. Like, as far as the amount of money that's flowing to government at every level is unprecedented. And we're nearing that end game.
Yeah, I think I'm going to go and make a radical statement here and say I think it's all right if you want to participate in the voting process. And
I would agree with that. It's just
out
interesting
to the establishment to... once again with my voting.
Hey man, I'm not going to mess with your deeply held religious beliefs. Right. So if you want to vote, please.
But I would take a certainly and this is a serious public policy point that sometimes people make is making voting compulsory or sort of insinuating that it's some sort of civic duty. I actually don't believe at all in compulsory political participation. It's actually one of the reasons why I think there is an issue with the way that we vote currently. It's an issue that I actually introduced, as a matter of fact, in the legislature. And it's the fact that all ballots are inherently approving. In other words, approving of the slate of government-approved candidates, right? And so the issue with that is that a real choice allows you to make an affirmative dissent. In other words, to say... I actually don't give permission to any of these candidates to serve in this office. It's called, you know, I called it none of the above, but it is a legitimate option that should exist if choice is, if we really want to provide people with a choice. The government has a ton of regulations in voting law, election law that restricts people from ballot access. And so in order to give people a real choice, none of the above absolutely should be a binding option on every ballot.
So functionally, how would that work? Like, if none of the above won, what happens next?
So there's actually precedent in the United States for none of the above. In fact, Nevada is a none of the above non-binding state. So what Nevada has basically set up is an opportunity to register your dissent. And even if none of the above wins, the next vote getter wins. In fact, and it just happened in the last two cycles, I believe, in the gubernatorial Democratic primary in Nevada, none of the above won. In a binding scenario, the way I had it introduced was that it would trigger a mandatory special election with new candidates. So the candidates that were on the ballot would no longer be able to run.
Interesting.
And of course, none of the above would still be an option. So at every turn, the public has the ability to affirmatively register their dissent with the slate of government approved candidates. And that is, I think, a middle ground that I think is actually doable and in the spirit of real choice, because you don't have, not voting is not the same as saying no. You know, in other words, being silent and letting people do what they will is not the same as saying, actually, I don't.
Because that enables this whole mandate narrative.
Correct.
The people chose X, when in point of fact, those who didn't participate had nothing to do with that choice.
And nobody was able to say, no, I don't approve of any of these candidates.
651-989-5855 for your thoughts on that concept. I do want to explore when we come back kind of how that went over, your attempt to move that through the legislature here in Minnesota. So we'll get that answer when we come back. Closing argument, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. An article just dropped at MinnPost. Apparently, Minnesota State Senator Dan Schoen has been accused of sexual harassment, and I only had time to get through a couple of paragraphs here, but wow, just absolute wow in terms of the things he's accused of having said and done.
Well, they documented it?
Well, apparently it's multiple. Legend. According to this, what does it say? Multiple women have spoken to MinnPost. Schoen, currently a first-term senator from Cottage Grove, previously served two terms in the House, also works as a paramedic and police officer in Cottage Grove, so he's making all kinds of people look good with this. The women describe behavior by Schoen that ranges from persistent and unwanted invitations to meet to physically grabbing women from behind. One woman, who asked not to be identified, here we go, said he sent her a photo of male genitalia. And, you know, I was talking with Brandon during the break. I'm like, I'm missing that gene. Like, I don't get the impulse to engage in that particular type of behavior. But apparently it's something that a number of guys do. I don't understand it. Go ahead and push your there you go.
Think about how this is sweeping like every sector of society right now. There are men who have not yet been accused who are having some very sleepless nights because there is a serious empowerment that I think most people like are behind regardless of any, like there's just something. So, you know, when you start talking about the, you know,
right.
And this is heavy duty stuff. And there's guys who have done it who are scared right now.
Well, I think there is something inherent to, cause there's a lot of the folks who are getting accused are political figures, right. You know, and celebrities. And I think both of those areas of human endeavor are similar in the sense that they provide this false sense of empowerment, this false sense of sort of extra legal status where you can just do things that other people can't do. That's very easy for guys in particular, apparently, to buy into and try to leverage in their personal relationships, even with according to all these accounts that we've heard, women who they've known for 5 minutes, you know, which just strikes me as inconceivable that you would take those kinds of liberties with somebody that you don't know at all and who could potentially go right to the cops or right to their husband or right to the paper and tell everybody what you just did.
It's absolutely predatory. I mean, you're right. It's a different gene. A different gene.
Well, and we say that, and at the same time, up until now, it has largely gone unpunished, obviously. Because we're seeing all these revelations now, right? Which that's the thing is they get this unearned sense of entitlement to be able to act that way, and then it gets reinforced by the lack of consequences up to this point. So, you know, to your point, Gary, I do think sleepless nights are definitely in store for folks. Closing argument, my name is Walter Hudson. We got the Haughty by Nature crew in here this evening. Brandon Peterson, Gary Miller, Carl Eggers. You can catch their podcast, Haughty by Nature. Just check it out on iTunes or your favorite podcatcher. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us this evening. We've been talking about, you know, the election that just took place. We've been focusing primarily on local stuff, the mayor's race, and just the general concept of voting. Did anything significant change yesterday? Are we in a brave new world? Is a wave of utopia about to sweep the city limits of Minneapolis?
Next election. Next election, we will get there, and the populist will take control, and everything will be right again.
Right.
We just need to get rid of the rhinos is really what needs to happen. And then we'll get to the other, you know, the other side. For instance, the other side. I mean, Walter, could you imagine a world in which the Republicans held the presidency, both houses of Congress,
right,
the Supreme Court?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if you grapple with that, I mean, it's a, there's probably not enough universes in the multiverse to have one that actually happens in. It'll never happen. So, you know what I'm saying?
I mean, we've only really dreamt of the things that are locked away in the subterranean vault of Paul Ryan and in the House, you know, budget committees, the secret tabulates of the most sacred conservative fiscal and tax policy that ever was. I mean, it's there. And could you imagine if one day, you know, Republicans held all three levers and could actually, I mean, the sort of efficiencies, I mean, we've talked about, you know, Congressman Paulson's, the finest tuned tweaking of the medical device tax you've ever seen to spawn innovation, the likes of which the world has never seen, right, in the industry. I mean, that's the sort of thing that could happen if only Republicans could vote harder, right, and elect more Republicans in all these branches. It'd be incredible. I mean, what do you think would happen? I mean, think of all the things that would happen, Walter.
Well, I mean, and, you know, we say this in jest, but going back to my political coming of age, you know, when I was in junior high and first learning about Republicans and Democrats and conservative and liberal from the likes of Rush Limbaugh, that was the carrot. And by the way, it's still the carrot he's putting in front of people, right? You know, over this very year, of if we just get more Republicans in office, we are going to see this conservative utopia sweep the land.
It's right over the next hill.
Unfortunately, we've already seen this movie before under George W. Bush, right, where they had total control of federal government and gave us, drum roll please, Medicare Part D, right? So it's a flawed premise, but somehow still remains effective in terms of a piece of rhetoric that brings people out. John from Shakopee, we will get to your call right as we return. We had a long segment last time, so this one was pretty short. We'll be right back. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Having fun rapping about politics and the news with the Haughty by Nature crew. Closing Arguments, the name of this program. My name's Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. We got Carl Eggers, Gary Miller, and Brandon Peterson in studio with us tonight, the Haughty by Nature guys. You can check out their podcast on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Going back to this notion we've been kind of chewing over regarding the value of voting, the nature of the political process that we take for granted, is certainly taken for granted in the public discourse. There's an aspect to the results of the Minneapolis City Council race that I find interesting and perhaps even ironic. And that's the celebration today of, you know, last night we found out that Minneapolis had its first, and the way it was reported was first transgender person of color. So apparently there must have been a transgender person. I don't know. Because why would you say of color unless they're just trying to kill two birds with that particular?
I think they were saying it because of the woman in Virginia, the transgender woman in Virginia who got elected earlier that night.
Oh, so this is like nationwide in city councils.
Perhaps. Or maybe it's just the first time it's been reported or people cared.
Regardless of the specificity of the historic moment that we're marking here, there's some...
Well, I need to know for my identity politics bingo board I've got over here, whether it's a black tranny or what we got to...
I don't think we got to
get
tranny.
It figured out.
No, we could totally say that. The FCC hasn't banned that one yet. So, they celebrated that last night. And then today, the news broke that after all the ranked choice voting fallout, that a second transgendered individual has been elected to the Minneapolis City Council. So you now have 2 out of 13 council members in Minneapolis who are transgendered. Now, the reason why I find this interesting is because particularly on the left, and particularly within the context of their preferred intersectional minority politics and how their focus on equity and disparities and whatnot. There's this concept that's constantly bandied about of disproportionate representation or disparate impact or however it is that you want to phrase it, where the basic premise is that if something applies to a given population in a proportion that's other than what their actual representation in the population is, like, for instance, if 13% of the population is black, but only 5% of college graduates are black, that's prima facie evidence of horrific racial injustice that needs to be addressed through some sort of government intervention, right?
Clearly.
So transgender people, and I looked this up through the beauty of the internet, represent 0.6% of the general population. As of today, they are represented by 15% of the Minneapolis City Council, right? So now, if you are a cisgendered Minneapolis resident...
I got bingo.
You got bingo?
You said cisgendered.
If you're a cisgendered, which is to say...
You're basically three quarters of the way to Nazi at that point, basically.
Well, this is true, but what I'm saying is that
we can say Nazi.
By their own logic, cisgendered people are underrepresented on the Minneapolis City Council at this point. Because they are 99.4% of the population. Is this a problem? And if not, why? By their logic.
Well, it's not about math. It's not about logic or reason here, right? I mean, you can't point numbers that, if we're 10%, then 10% of our politicians have to be of the same way. It's about some value of justice, some, you know, nebulous value of equity and justice, like you talked about, some, you know, Lockean or Rawlsian, I guess, value that we have to equate justice between disparate groups, and that it will never be good enough, right?
Right.
There's never an end game.
Is there? It raises the question, and I would like to. And look, if by some chance there's a lefty who's pressed scan accidentally in his car and is running past the station, by all means, call in 651-989-5855, because I would love to have a sincere, thoughtful answer to this question. Is there a point past which you have gone too far? Like, if they had, I don't know, 7 out of the 13 city council members transgendered, would we have to scale back? Would we have to put on the brakes lest we disenfranchise the sisses, if that's even a term?
Now, you cannot. So the serious answer, I think, here is that the left does not recognize any sort of aggression against the established hierarchical power structures that exist within society. I think that's the serious answer to that.
No, I think you're right. I think
you can't cisgender, white, you know, all things white, in like the capital W white, you know, cannot be
right.
You cannot oppress or sort of be prejudiced to in any offensive manner to those established. So no, I mean, it would just be okay. Well, they would celebrate it on HuffPost and Salon magazine and say this is a turning point. We've now achieved 8. Transsexual city council members on. I mean, this it would be.
We've seen that
happen. Lauded and celebrated.
We've seen that happen alphabetically, from LGBT or LGBT to LGBTQ, etc. Mm-hmm. Like, they're just continuing to extend the alphabet of these are the groups that we have special.
And you know, if there are 8 that just happen to run, and they're whatever they are, they're the best candidates for their area. You know, whatever.
More power.
Great, great. But you're right. I mean, it's not just about that. It's not just about merit. There, on the left, the identity, you know, box that you check is absolutely a part of the resume. And it's a very relevant part of the resume when they're looking at these things.
It makes me wonder whether or not, because that bears out in terms of what Jamar Nelson, who we had on the program to help us analyze the election results last night, said. You know, when I raised the issue of, you know, whites becoming a minority, and he was saying the Democrats don't need to try to court their votes anymore. Well, is there a half-life to majority status? Like, 50 years from now, if the transgenders control the majority on the city councils, is there a point at which the cisgenders do become an oppressed minority? I don't know the answer to that question, and we don't have time to delve into it too great. Closing argument, Haughty by Nature have been with us this evening. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Talk AM 1130 103.5 FM. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. Two ways to stream the program. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you tuning in. Catch up on the podcasts. If you missed the program, you can find that in your iHeartRadio app. Just do a search for Closing Argument. Our channel will pop right up. 651-989-5855. If you want to get in on our conversation this evening with our in-studio guests, the Haughty by Nature crew. Haughty by Nature is a podcast you can find on iTunes or wherever free podcasts are downloaded on a routine basis. Carl Eggers, Gary Miller, Brandon Peterson are the three guys who you'll hear on that podcast. And, you know, basically what you do, you know, Carl, you're the only one in the room at the moment. The other guys got lost in the maze between here and the bathroom.
They're conversing about gender studies.
Yes, they're.
The evolution and...
That's only a half joke. That's actually kind of happening right now.
Yeah, it is. Yep.
But, you know, a fair description... Actually, it's not even my description. I think it's how you've described the podcast is, you know, a conversation, a bar between guys who are generally libertarian-leaning, run the spectrum of what might be considered libertarian thought. And just reacting not only to the news, but the culture and sports and what have you. What is, you know, because I've only listened to a couple of episodes so far myself. What is the most obscure topic you guys have? Because you're also unedited.
Yeah.
You just turn it on and go.
Yeah.
And there's not really a plan as far as I know it. Maybe a general topic, but not like a this is what we're going to talk about from minute to minute type deal. So what's the most obscure thing that you've just tripped upon in terms of... this recording that you do.
I'll tell you, we had an episode that we released on last Saturday about Marianne Stebbins.
Sure.
And she ran the Ron Paul campaign in 2008, 2012 here in Minnesota. And we all know her personally and have tremendous respect for her. But that literally came about 5 minutes before we're about to hit record of like, hey, how did you get involved in, oh, Marianne? Yeah, me too. I kind of got, and then that's how we got to that episode. But in terms of, you know, esoteric topics, gosh, I don't know. Gary, to his credit, Gary made a Lord of the Rings reference that neither Brandon nor I got. I got really? That it was, I assumed it was Lord of the Rings and I was right, but I didn't get it. But yeah, we're just trying to twist and turn between politics and life and food and sports and culture. I mean, we spent our last recording, we spent a good 45 minutes talking about TV shows and, you know, our favorite ones and what do it, and then go flip it to Cal Exit. And flip it to the impending war with Iran that we'll get into next year, you know, and just kind of twist and turn and have segments, have topics, and keep and talk at length about them, but not be afraid to take a right turn on them. Like the Catholicism example that Brandon brought up, that came about because Brandon went out to get food, and Gary and I were talking about our personal life and in our religious backgrounds, and so I brought up what Gary thought about Catholicism out of the blue, and. You know, we started talking, so I just,
So that
just,
actually happened.
Yeah. I just, hey, what do you think about this kind of thing?
Right.
And just go and we don't edit much. But when we have to, we do.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it. And, I definitely am going to catch up with, the episodes you guys have done for, how frequently do you push one out?
We release, two episodes a week.
Okay.
Tuesdays and Saturdays release episodes, and we have a whole bunch of content ready to go, and so we're excited. And again, like we had an episode we just talked about gay marriage, drugs, Cal Exit, abortion, God's relationship or man's relationship with God and state. And then it's like, we can't release all of this stuff. Like, you know, one, like, let's talk about abortion and then gay marriage. Like, that's pretty heavy for us to do one after another. So we try to break it up a little bit.
Sure. So, I mean, what occurs to me as you describe it is the link between these things. Because on its face, it seems kind of random, you know, going in and out of cultural references and then back to politics and then talking about sports or whatever. But I think there's something that the left inherently understands, or at least seems to have understood over the years, based upon their occupation of the cultural space with Hollywood and the arts and what have you, is that these aspects of our lives, you know, the stories that we tell and that we consume and the activities that we engage in culturally, be it, you know, sports or whatever the case may be, it kind of serves a similar role, I think, in our conscious lives that dreams serve in our unconscious lives. Sure. Yeah. Where the purpose of dreaming is to kind of process things that have happened and kind of what's that terminology used in IT when your hard drive gets too fragmented, defrag. To kind of defrag your mind,
yeah,
is basically the purpose that dreaming serves. I think the arts and our entertainment, the stories that we tell, the games that we play, serves a very similar function in a more conscious way. And we have the opportunity when we're analyzing something like The Walking Dead,
right,
or Game of Thrones or whatever the case may be, to consider these ideas in a particular space where our brain is operating at a certain frequency, where the stakes aren't as, they're not high and they're not direct and they're not imminent. And so we're able to allow ourselves to think about them in a different way, take more risks in a sort of way, if that makes any sense.
Right. And Walter, I know you well enough to know that you're not a member of this, but even though you have a show on a conservative talk radio station, but people get so pigeonholed and focused and stressed about the politics issue du jour and my party's success or failures, and that's all that matters to my existence is politics.
Right.
And that is a really dangerous, scary place to be. And I think we've all been there at times, right?
Sure.
Where it consumes you.
Yep.
And the Lord of the Rings allegory there with the ring is I think is relevant here. It consumes your being. And so what we're trying to do is, you know, let's take a step back, look at it, prioritize the important things like family. Like happiness, and we can talk about politics. We can talk. We can be all passionate about those. We can have fun with it, but don't let that be your sole reason for existence. Is the state of the Republican Party or Trump or Hillary or anything?
Well, I mean, it gets to a point, and it can very quickly. And I've seen this happen with activists, candidates, politicians, whatever the case may be. You can end up putting the cart before the horse, because the whole point of our interest in politics is in order to attempt to craft a world in which we can survive and thrive and enjoy our lives and pursue values. And if the political endeavor gets to the point where it's actually robbing you of your capacity to serve the end for which politics exists, then you're a snake swallowing its own tail at that point.
That's the reason for politics to exist, right? For individuals involved in campaigns and elections and politics is to prop up the importance of the political system and of my election and of how much it means to you, the lowly voter, to vote for me. I will save your problems, and the next election will beat the bad guy next time.
Right.
Building up that importance,
right,
that, you know, that fraudulent aspect of life, I think, is the whole point, right? If you take a step back and look, Jacob Frey's election is not going to change my life. Even if I was a Minneapolis resident, the mayor of Bloomington, Gene Winstead, lives down the block from me. Why don't I just go talk? I don't need to vote for him or vote against him. Go talk to him and say, what the hell, man?
Yeah.
You know, that is a better way to equip yourself, I think, in social civilization than, well, I can't wait till 2 years next November. I get to put a little dot on a piece of paper and then hope my life gets better. And that's our whole part of our reason for the podcast.
There are times when, you know, I'm daydreaming in the car, whatever the case may be, where I entertain the thought of how it might go over, or whether it would, quote, work to have a political campaign or be part of a political campaign that actually tried to flip that script, that instead of hyping the importance of this is the most important election we've ever had and my candidacy is the panacea that's going to cure all ills, and if somebody took basically the path that you just articulated, it was like, look, politics is important, mm-hmm, government has the capacity to affect your life for good or ill, and it is important to put some thought into this, but look, this is not going to solve everything. whether I'm elected or not elected, whether my opponent's elected or not elected. And what we need to do is go beyond just checking the name on the box. We need to ask the question of what it is we're trying to accomplish and how we as a community are going to take actions outside the ballot box to actually manifest that. The days of trying to find the person, and I say this as a libertarian and a Republican who was on the Ron Paul train, right? Mm-hmm. I think, and this is ironic for libertarians, for a lot of libertarians, Ron Paul was the panacea.
Right.
It was like, if we can just get Ron Paul elected, that's going to solve all our problems. The mm-hmm. Fed's going to end. We're going to go back to the gold standard. You know, we're going to pull troops out of everywhere and, mm-hmm. and go back to a Jefferson-esque sense of republicanism and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
When that was never true. Like in the actual obtainable practical ideal of Ron Paul gets elected, what happens the next day? The answer is, in effect, what's happening to Donald Trump right now, right? Like where he got elected president, so what? There's still a Congress, there's still courts, there's still the media, there's still the culture. You know, there is no way by which you can shortcut the process of, if you want to change society, you have to change society. Like society has to change. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You're not going to change it through electing a guy, you know, whether that guy's for Congress or president or whatever the case may be. And I think that for the reasons that you articulate, we've crafted and I'm using a very general we here, the society, American society has crafted this idea and promoted this idea of politics as a solution to social problems.
To every
social
problem.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that is just inherently flawed. And the danger of it is that it takes the responsibility off of where it actually lies, which is on the individual people to live their lives and run their relationships in such a way as that it affects change to the extent that they can.
And that's kind of our point with the voting thing. And there's a lot of, we try to be fun with it and funny, but also there's some point to it that you create change a lot quicker and more effectively to help go have dinner with your neighbor or to go to help the person in need down the street than you do waiting every 2 years for an election. So if that's how you want to solve society's problems, is wait 2 years to put a dot on a piece of paper or even participate in your party's process, and you're not talking to your neighbor, you're not giving those to a need, you're not talking, you know, just being a good person for whatever that means, then you are a bad person to me. You're a flawed, miserable person that only cares about Fox News / MSNBC / whatever the parties and the establishment tell you. And that's what's wrong with society to me, is that's what we hold up. And that's the solution, the cause of and or solution to life's problems is politics.
I thought, according to Homer Simpson, it was alcohol.
It can be both. Exactly.
Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Carl Eggers from the Haughty by Nature podcast in studio with me. We're going to go roam the halls and see if we can find the other two here. Closing argument, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. All right. We're down to Carl Eggers now. This is what happens on this show. We're so loose about how we
so
program things here. We're so haughty that, you know, guests come and they go. It's kind of like a dorm room. People show up, they leave when they want. You know, that's just how it goes.
Sadly, very much like that and when we record.
Absolutely. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855. If you want to join us and fill one of the virtual seats here on the program this evening. You know, we've been talking an awful lot about the limitations, the inherent limitations of politics and the electoral system and what it is that, you know, the dominant cultural memes and narratives that inform our conventional political discourse. And, you know, it's with some irony that I actually want to turn back to that conventional analysis to talk about what happened nationally last night, because it was noteworthy. And I talked about this a little bit with Jamar Nelson, who we had in studio to help us break down and analyze the results as they were coming in. And he, of course, is Democrat, liberal. He's got the show Black Republican, Black Democrat, which you can hear on this air on Saturdays at 6 p.m., obviously very passionate, very devoted Democrat who thinks that Republicans are nuts and conservatives are crazy. And, you know, the question that I presented to him was, because there's been this narrative since the election of Donald Trump from the left, that every given special election that has taken place in the past year was a referendum on Trump, right? Up until it didn't go their way, and then that narrative conveniently was swept away of, well, it's not really that big of a deal, it's not that important. Until last night, when they grabbed two governor seats, and now it's, here it is, here's our moment, which to my mind kind of goes back to what we were talking about last hour in terms of this notion of the mandate. Is it really, and this is where I turn it over to you, Carl, is this really a rebuke of Donald Trump, or is this to a large degree the same type of disengagement from the process that gave us Donald Trump in the first place? Because, you know, just looking at the statistics from 2016, it was far more Democrats not voting that gave us Donald Trump than it was Republicans coming out in droves to support him.
Well, it's simply a straw man, isn't it? They're looking for some validation, some higher meaning as to why things occurred. And my preferred meaning is that everybody is against Trump, me being a Democrat, right? That's right, what I want people to think and see. Look, I see, you know, look at this. See, this exactly proves my point, except when it doesn't.
Yeah.
Right. And so they're attaching value to things that may not exist. I mean, it's seriously like finding Jesus in a piece of toast.
Sure.
Right. Like, oh, see, this must be a sign because this kind of looks like something that I could make out to be my Messiah.
Right. Right.
And you can't attribute value to things that don't have inherent value. And I think elections are part of that, that just because one person or group of people win an election, maybe against, you know, the predictions, doesn't make it a mandate or doesn't make it a sweeping national tide.
And let me tell you why I know that to be true. In 2010, you know, let's move the snapshot, right? Let's move the Overton window that we're considering here to 2010. In the aftermath of the massive Tea Party wave, right? I was doing the same thing as an individual and corporately with the organizations and people and friends that I was involved with at the time that Democrats are doing right now, which is attributing, deriving from the electoral victory, the conclusion that the broader culture had latched onto and, you know, given a mandate to these Tea Party principles of fiscal responsibility, constitutionally limited government, free markets, what have you. And certainly, if not the general population, then the Republican Party was obviously moving in this direction. Mm-hmm. And the Republican base and the Republican electorate was obviously moving in that direction. And isn't it a wonderful thing? And aren't there wonderful things yet to come? Then 2016 comes. And virtually all of that, like the actual ideas, gets flushed down the toilet. Mm-hmm. And now it's Trump time. Now it's time for, you know, populism and tariffs and economic intervention, and we're gonna give companies certain breaks and cut deals in order to keep jobs here because that's what's important for the American worker. It's like 180 degrees opposite of what the Tea Party was about, which to me, the conclusion I derive from that is that it's wrong, as you just said, to assume that because there a certain narrative was being promoted during a given electoral campaign, that it's in any way indicative of where people's actual values are.
It's confirmation bias, right?
Yeah.
Where, you're assigning that my hypothesis or my ultimate conclusion I'm going to get to is X. And so everything that fits in that assumption or in that theory proves my point. And everything that doesn't, that everything that may disprove my point, I disregard because you can't look at those things because X, Y, and Z. So you're assigning value. You presuppose a narrative. You have a narrative that you follow or the media gives to you during the whole campaign. And the elections either prove that or were irrelevant to your narrative.
Right.
Right. And it never shows that, well, maybe the Republican Party isn't engulfed in a Tea Party wave in 2012.
Right.
You know.
And so here's the hard pill to swallow for people who are part of the Trump wave now, right? The Trump wave coming out of 2016 is that this applies to you as well. You know, that same sense of euphoria that I had in 2010 with the Tea Party wave has been, and that is being adopted now by the Democrats in the wave of their victories last night, in these two gubernatorial races, the same confirmation bias applies to your reaction to Donald Trump winning. You know, when Steve Bannon and, you know, folks of that stripe, Sean Hannity, whatever the case may be, over this very air, you know, comes out and says in the aftermath of the 2016 election, this is an affirmation of everything that Donald Trump said and stood for and wants to do. There is an inherent flaw to that logic. And we're starting to see that potentially, you know, with the results that we saw last night. And this is where I will give the Democrats some amount of leeway in what it is that they're trying to say, is that it's and we also saw it in terms of the result with, I think it was Alabama, with Roy Moore. Yeah, Roy Moore. Mm-hmm. And Trump had endorsed the other person and what have you. These things are not written in stone. The populace goes in the direction that it goes, and sometimes there's a logic to it and sometimes there's not. And at no point, you know, this is basically the thesis that I'm working up to here, is that at no point do you get to lay claim to the system. Like, at no point do you get to say, this is the way it is now, and the rest of you have to go home. You know, because it's the stage is always set for the next revolution.
Right.
Right. And, you know, it's because of that, it's hard to answer the question from a conventional point of view of what is the thing that I'm holding out for in terms of my continued political activism.
But and not to contradict myself here, but what would you attribute it to? And especially in 2016, there clearly was a large segment of the population that supported Trump, and
right.
Trump was there,
yep.
Just as there was a large part of the population that people were for Hillary or against Trump, one or the other. I understand how the losers of the election will try to claim that, nope, this is our side pushing up and pushing against the tide that is
right.
the bad guys on the other side.
Right.
But there's got to be some cultural shift to elect Donald Trump.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, just as there was in 2008 to elect Barack Obama. I mean, so it's not... There are narratives to follow, and there are waves and ebbs and flows, but you can't assume that your wave is the only one.
Exactly, and that's the point that I'm getting to, is by describing it as an ebb and a flow and a wave and something that's fluid, you're conceding the fact that it's something that's in motion. Hmm. And I think what happens is that these snapshots are taken by, you know, whatever the coalition is, whatever the movement is, whether it was the Tea Party in 2010 or the Trump movement in 2016 or the Democrats right now, the resistance, you know, right now, whoever it is, there's this tendency, just a human tendency, to take a snapshot of the moment and say, this is the direction we're going. You know, it's kind of like I'm losing it. Sometimes you have those thoughts that start to take shape in your head and you immediately lose them. That's what's happening here. But there's this concept of, you know, I forget the exact name of the bias, but assuming that things are going to continue in the same direction that they are. Like, okay, here's the example.
Recency bias? And there's others. Yeah.
So if somebody was literally born yesterday, right? They were literally born yesterday. They've never lived a day in their life. And they wake up in the morning and the temperature's going up. You know, it starts out at 69 and then it goes up to 74, then it goes up to 76 by noon. As far as they're concerned, they are going to die, right? Yeah, because the longer the day ticks on, the higher the temperature gets. And it's the assumption that things are going to continue on the trend that I'm seeing right now. And in lack of information to the contrary, or the experience to discern that that's not actually the way it's going to continue to go, you end up making an error in judgment. That type of thing happens politically all the time.
And not to get too haughty here and take a right turn, but climate change is a perfect example. I mean, using the temperature example, that if these trends continue, which we have to assume they will,
right,
and on these you know, multitude of variables that we think we have an idea and we can project, we will see levels will rise by 2002 and New York will be underwater.
Yes.
Oh, well, didn't happen, did it?
Right.
Even though CO2 levels have gone, you know, up and up since then. So to your point, I mean, and I think politics is a great example, that the infinite amount of variables involved in electing a Donald Trump,
right,
that doesn't necessarily mean that there are large groups of people, and by the tens and hundreds of millions of groups of people, that act in unison and can kind of, you know, I think the wave is a good analogy of that, can take over in wave until the next wave comes through,
right,
like that,
which can be informed by something completely different.
Right, as the cultural shifts, cultural priorities change, that's inevitably going to change.
Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Got Carl Eggers in here from the Haughty by Nature podcast, 651-989-5855. If you want to join us this evening, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. From the Star Tribune, the Ramsey County Public Defender's Office clashed with the state courts Monday when one of its attorneys was found in contempt of court after she refused to show up for a jury trial because of a heavy caseload. The attorney's supervisor also was found in contempt in the rare occurrence, which signaled an uprising years in the making that pitted the overworked public defender's office against a court system rooted in tradition. Monday's development came on the very day the public defender's office enacted a number of changes it says were ignored or unwelcomed by the courts. We have a guest on the phone to discuss this with us tonight on Closing Argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com, and your iHeartRadio app, two ways to stream us. Mike Melios is his name. He's on the line. Welcome to the program, sir. Appreciate you calling in, especially this late.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So what kind of insight can you give us into what the situation is here with an overworked public defender's office in Ramsey County?
Sure. Like you said, this is something that has been a long time coming. I was previously a public defender in the military, and then when I got off active duty, I served in the St. Paul Public Defender's Office, or rather Ramsey County Public Defender's Office. And the system that they have is you're on this trial block. And so you're prepping for a jury trial, and you're on call for about 4 weeks. And so as a trial attorney, it's very difficult to be prepared when you're on call. And then, by the way, your caseload doesn't get any smaller. You just don't sit idly. And so you have all the other proceedings to take care of as well. So really what happened is on Monday, the public defender, you know, she just said, you know, I have these other proceedings that I need to attend to, and I can't go to trial this week. And things seem to boil over from there.
So, I mean, the practical effect of this, it sounds like, is that you have clients, so to speak, who are not being represented in an effective manner because the attorneys that they've been assigned are dealing with this heavy caseload that makes it impossible for them to give them their full attention or adequate attention, at least.
Right. That can be the case. Because frequently when, you know, your case is coming up for trial, if you're in that public defender's office or even in the private sector, you have to ask other counsel to cover for you so that other client, you know, right, isn't getting the benefit of the attorney that they've been working with.
Right. Yeah. It's pretty interesting because, you know, it raises the issue of how we even interpret this right to representation. And having not spoken to you before, I'm not sure what position you're coming at it from. But do you think that there's something to the way that the system is set up that makes it to where a situation like this is inevitable? And tangential to that, are there steps, you know, it's cited here in the article that we just read, that there are certain reforms that the public defender's office seeks. Are you aware of those, and are there any that you think would actually make a difference in this situation?
Yeah, the public defender's office is definitely trying, and they've recommended changes. And still, at the end of the day, in Ramsey, it's a volume issue. I mean, you can try to rearrange schedules as much as you can, but still just the pure amount of cases that each of these assistant public defenders has, I mean, is overwhelming. I think that is the cause of the problem. I mean, it may get better if the county maybe implements, maybe you're only on call for 1 week for trial, or maybe even goes with a date certain. Mm-hmm. Trial date. But no, it's going to take the system working together. You know, if it's the county attorney's office coming up with more creative rehabilitation type solutions,
right?
Like such as diversion, and just brings the number, because the court needs to move these cases as well, because the victims in the case have a right to
right. Yeah.
Have cases proceed.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is it's kind of a supply and demand issue, and one of the two has to be adjusted. And to some extent, you can adjust the supply by changing either the laws or how they're implemented. But then that raises the question of, you know, by what criteria? Because you don't want it to be arbitrary. You don't want people committing crimes and those crimes not being dealt with just to, in order to solve a public defender issue. But at the same time, it raises the question of, why is the workload so high, and, you know, what can be done within reason to lower it?
Right. I mean, it is the volume.
Yeah.
You know, I think this isn't unique to Ramsey County. You know, most public defenders' offices are overwhelmed. You don't come across, you know, many public defenders that are, you know, twiddling their thumbs looking for work.
Sure. All right. I appreciate it. Thanks for calling in, Mike Melios, principal attorney for Melios Law. And we appreciate your insights. We'll have you on again sometime.
Yeah. Sounds good.
Appreciate it. Yep. You too. And in the midst of that segment, we got Gary Miller back. And apparently there was some sordid tale, some sort of crusade that took place while you were gone that you were involved in, and you somehow found your way back into the radio studio?
Well, we got involved, embroiled, I would say is a better word, in a conversation about sexual, gender, political labels. So it
wow.
Yeah. But then, so I'm going to tell really what happened here.
Okay.
So at the top of the hour, so we had kind of this notion we were going to hang around for a couple hours. And then at the top of the hour, it seemed like it was like you had kind of dismissed us. So I think Brandon and I both looked at each other like, well, I think we're done here. Like we just assumed by the way you ended the hour, it was very abrupt, but it seemed very final as well. So I thought we both had this conclusion that we had been shown the door.
So what I was trying to do there, this is our behind the curtain peek,
right? This is what
production of the show is. It actually hadn't been established, because this is how well we prepare for a closing argument here on Twin Cities News Talk. We had not established before how long you guys were going to stay, and knowing from previous experience that Brandon might want to go home,
right?
I wanted to create the situation in which he felt comfortable doing so.
Sure.
So that's why I created that sense of finality. What I forgot to do is
clue me in.
Is to actually be like, hey, you guys can stick around if you want, right? Like,
right.
So, and Carl, of course, just was like, I'm here.
Yeah.
I ain't moving. So
that's brilliant. It's a great story to tell.
It is.
Well, Brandon does that on our podcast.
It just leaves.
Yeah. What? He'll just be like, oh, I'm going to go. I got to have something being delivered. I'm going to go.
Yeah.
Like, nice. Okay. Bye.
We're done. Yeah, and
as we're recording.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess that lends itself to the authenticity. All right. We got one more segment. Stick with us. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Got Carl Eggers and Gary Miller from the Haughty by Nature podcast in with us tonight. 651-989-5855 if you want to join us. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, twincitiesnewstalk.com. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. In studio with me tonight, Haughty by Nature, got Carl Eggers, Gary Miller, and the absent, once present, Brandon Peterson, who we, of course, have his seat with a coat on it, just to kind of keep it friendly, keep it open in case he decides he's going to drop in once again, because we've already lost one of you and got him back.
Right.
Over the course of the show. So there is a possibility that we'll get the whole crew back up and running.
They do that in the state Senate still, actually. They have a seat on the state Senate floor for Brandon.
Nice.
Keeping it warm for him.
Good. That makes me feel good. It really does, because we could certainly use that perspective in the Senate once more. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us. Let's go to Corey in Bloomington. Thanks for holding. How you doing tonight?
Not pretty good.
Good. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I was wondering if Donald Trump could come to CD5 and help elect some of the senators and governor that's up for re-election.
In CD5?
Yeah.
Is that what I heard?
Yeah.
I don't know if Trump would be able to pull that off. I mean, like, physically coming here? Yeah, sure, he could. But, I mean, I don't know that his presence would make the difference in CD5, of all places. Because that's Minneapolis, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it'd certainly be entertaining. I mean, he did come here. I appreciate your call, Corey. He did come here during the 2016 election, and there was some hoopla that resulted from it. I think that was kind of like Antifa before it was Antifa showed up.
Oh, really?
During the campaign. Yeah, it was the same folks, but and I think they actually did call themselves Antifa, but it was before anybody really knew what that meant.
Was it a fundraiser downtown?
No, it was a rally.
It was a rally.
It was a rally. And there was some violence, and there was some controversy regarding whether or not the police response was intense enough or appropriate enough or whatever the case may be.
Ironically, that was right across the street from CD5, because that airstrip at the airport is like across Highway 62 from CD5. So I'll have to stop by next time.
There you go. I'm curious, and you two guys in particular, and it would have been interesting to get Brandon's take on this as well, but I will definitely settle for you two. That was a specific choice of language. This ongoing dispute between Governor Mark Dayton and the legislature regarding funding. Now, from a libertarian perspective, from each of your personalized libertarian perspectives, is there a reaction to this drama that on one level is like, good, keep it up, as long as you can have anything defunded by any means, I'm all for it? Or is that trumped by the constitutional question of whether or not the governor's exceeded his constitutional authority here?
Or number three... or number three, I look at these two warring parties like two medieval thieves deciding who's going to get the sack full of gold coins. It's stolen and purloined money. So it's two illegitimate entities wrestling over some stolen loot. That's what I see.
There you go. That's why I ask with Gary Miller in the room, because I know I'm going to get that unconventional answer.
But the only question I have is it constitutional, right? Which the Supreme Court has said, or they're going
the status of it, according to Harry Niska, who we had on the program to analyze the decision, which I would put in support, in scare quotes, immediately after it happened, was that the Supreme Court basically decided they weren't going to rule one way or the other. They kicked the can down the road and ordered this mediation, which came and went in a day. They barely even tried to mediate, and nothing has happened since, which to my mind raises the question of why. Like, why hasn't the Supreme Court followed up and actually made a ruling, either upholding or overruling the lower court?
From my, rule of law being the highest order, kind of perspective, that'd be my only question, is it legally allowed? But from, to Gary's point, it's just two partisan entities. And, the Dowd's, argument against it is, think of the staffers.
Think of
the people that depend on the pay. Think of the couple dozen hundred people that depend on this. And it's just I have no empathy whatsoever for researchers. Like, well, they'll never come back. If they get laid off, they'll never come back and work at the state capitol. So,
sure.
Good riddance. Good. Yeah. I hope they don't come back.
There's an effective style of rhetoric surrounding this issue, which is rooted in the representation of the electorate and what have you, and having co-equal branches of government and all that, that I think is... Even if you're like Gary and you don't buy into, you don't think there's any real value in any of it. Like, I understand that perspective. But even so, I tend more towards your argument, Carl, of the rule of law and the structure, ought to be enforced. And, so that's where I would focus. But yes, when you start to cite the poor personal human interest story of the staffer who, is going to have to go down the corner bar instead of, researching at the Capitol for untold hours, it's hard for me to relate that. And I got to imagine it's hard for most people to relate to that type of situation.
It's not sexy to make the constitutional rule of law argument, and Dowd's not the person to do that either. So say what you will about Mark Dayton, but it's like the only argument is keep going. I hope there's a stalemate is kind of where I'm at with that. And I hope it lasts forever and delays session. I mean, I think that would be more interesting than having some
flaccid
compromise.
I actually don't think that can happen. And maybe that's what this is. Maybe what the court's doing is they're running out the clock. Because my understanding, and maybe I'm wrong, is that when session starts again, it resets everything and they've got their funding back. That the real only question is...
No.
Between now and then. Okay, fill us in.
He vetoed their funding for next year, I thought it was, because they set the budget a year ahead of time.
Uh-huh.
And so they have enough money appropriated from their last budget to make it through.
Make it through till the session?
Supposedly, or maybe the Senate is...
Okay, so it's a process issue.
Yes.
Of once they're back in session, they can readdress the question.
Yes.
In other words, they could have overruled, and probably would have overruled his veto if they had remained in session, but the fact that they are not in session is why he was able to do this and why this standoff even exists.
Well, and kind of going taking this full circle back to how can our society possibly operate without Kurt Dowd's researchers working in the basement of some office building in St. Paul?
I know it's had a profound personal effect on my life.
I know. I think I'll just stop and sit in my bed all day and ponder. If once those researchers come back to work, I'll feel a lot better.
I mean, I can say that it has literally affected the last 5 minutes because we did talk about it.
Damn it.
You know, but talking about it really is the full extent of the impact. Appreciate having you guys on with us tonight. Once again, Haughty by Nature is the name of their podcast. You can find it on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Do so. It's worth your time. Some insight, some humor, and maybe even some liberty might be coming your way. Closing Argument is the name of this show. My name's Walter Hudson. 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you tuning in. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
Thanks, buddy.